Hello, and welcome to today's live stream with the Online Wisdom Library for Mission members. Today's live stream is with Dr. Carrie Demers. It's called Your Brain on Meditation, and she's going to talk about the various benefits of doing meditation and how it affects the brain. And she'll also go into the concept of neuroplasticity, which will be really exciting to hear about. I want to take just a moment to thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for your support as Mission members. It allows us to be able to bring you live streams like this, also Mission programming, the Online Wisdom Library. It supports our humanitarian efforts and so much more. So thank you very much. I'm Serena Jedalina, and I'm going to introduce Dr. Demers today. She is board certified in integrative medicine. She's been the medical director of the Puriju Wellness Center for the last 20 years here at the Himalayan Institute. And after receiving her degree from the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Demers knew that that was only just half of the picture. So she went on to study homeopathy, yoga, Ayurveda, massage, herbal medicine, you name it, and it continues. She continues to study, and her wisdom and depth and compassion astounds me. Dr. Demers is widely regarded in her field for her expertise. She's been a contributor to many publications and continues to contribute to our Online Wisdom Library here at the Himalayan Institute and also to yogainternational.com. So she's helped me in ways I can't even express. I love this woman so much. It's a great honor to introduce Dr. Carrie Demers to you today.
Thank you, It's such a pleasure to be here. So the topic today is about meditation and how it affects our brain. So I went on PubMed and I looked at how many studies have happened, how many studies have there been on meditation? And there's been over 4,000. And what's interesting is that science is really enraptured by meditation recently. So three-fourths of those studies, about 3,000 of them, have been in the last 10 years. So why is that? Why is science excited about meditation? It's mostly because what we're seeing is that meditation helps a lot of things, a lot of medical problems. Initially, meditation was a focus of attention for treating mental illness or for mental health. So we looked at it in terms of treating anxiety and depression, drug addiction, and anger management, right? But then in the more recent years, we've seen meditation be used as a treatment for heart disease and high blood pressure, for cancer survivorship, for endocrine problems, infertility. So many things, even dermatology, even skin conditions, autoimmune diseases, so many medical concerns, chronic medical concerns have been affected by meditation. But today's focus is to look at meditation and the brain. So to start that, I want to begin with some definitions. So this word, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity describes the liveliness of our nervous systems, the ability of our nervous system to respond and change, to grow and react, to modify itself in response to our experiences, to learning, to stress, and to our thoughts. So in response to all that we're experiencing in life, our nervous system creates interconnections in itself. So the nervous system cells are called neurons, and they connect to each other via axons and dendrites. So that's their connectors. So the body can build more dendrites, more connection to more cells based on the richness of our experience. You've probably heard the term nerves that fire together, wire together. So basically, when we link things in space and do them over and over again, we create hard, this wiring, these nervous system connections are then really cemented into our nervous system. So for instance, in the old days, my mom would have a cup of coffee and a cigarette, okay? So we pattern that in ourselves. Every time I have a cup of coffee, I'm looking for the cigarette. Or maybe it's wine and a cigarette. Maybe it's whatever it is for you, chocolate and your 3 o'clock cup of tea, whatever it is. We pattern things together, and then they're neurologically hardwired in us. They're connected neurologically. We can also break those. We can also prune away connections that we no longer use or need. So maybe I give up smoking, and now I no longer choose that when I'm drinking my coffee. So over time, those connections are broken down, pruned actually, and I don't have that association anymore when I drink my coffee. Right? So that adaptability, that liveliness is what I mean by neuroplasticity. The other word that I want to define here is neurogenesis. Neurogenesis means the ability of our nervous systems to create new cells. Now, if you're my age, 50s, maybe even younger, we were taught that it's not possible, that our nervous systems don't make new cells. In medicine, we were taught that when people had a stroke and certain nerve cells were killed, that we actually recruited other cells to step in and do the work of the cells that were killed. But what we know now, and actually have known for about 20 years, is that our bodies can make new nerve cells and do make new nerve cells. And what we'll see in a minute is that meditation is one of the ways that builds new, more density in our cerebral cortex. All right. Now, when we think about meditation, many meditative techniques, and certainly the one that we teach here at the Institute, use breath as a mental anchor to begin to put us into a meditative state. And I thought I'd spend a moment on talking about why that is. Why do meditative traditions use the breath or breath awareness as a foundation for meditative practice? So what we know is that most of the time when we're engaged in the world, we have a lot of activity in what's called our sympathetic nervous system. That part of our nervous system is about, well, we think of it as being our fight or flight response. But there's activity in the sympathetic system even when we're not in fight or flight. We're not in panic mode. We're just doing our day. We're engaged outwardly. Our senses are engaged in the world outside of us. We're assessing, we're deciding, we're acting, we're accomplishing things, we're doing. And we're interfacing with the world outside of us. That engagement in everyday life requires what I would call sympathetic tone, activity in that part of our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system. When we breathe deeply, deep and slow and even, we activate, we bring more activity into the opposite of that, into our parasympathetic nervous system. So that simple act of breathing shifts the autonomic nervous system into a more restorative state, into a more inward-focused state. And instead of being alert to our environment, we foster a sense of peace, calm, and safety in that when that system is activated. So on the board here, I wrote the SNS to mean sympathetic nervous system. So this would be what we commonly call our fight or flight system. And our parasympathetic nervous system is often called our rest and digest system. So most of the time we live here in our day-to-day life, we have activity in that sympathetic system. And when we breathe or calm down or relax or on vacation, we create more activity in that parasympathetic system. Now, those of you who are watching that are experienced meditators know this already, but I know some of you out there are new to meditation or maybe just curious about meditation. So I'm going to have us sit and do a brief breath awareness practice. So everybody find a seat. And even if you're watching this while you're doing something else, folding the laundry or something, put it aside and sit down in a comfortable chair or on the floor, if that's where you're comfortable, and find stillness in your body. So you can close your eyes and feel your body rest on the surface beneath you. So let your sit bones really anchor down into the seat of the chair or the floor that you're sitting on. If you're sitting in a chair, feel your feet on the floor. Let your feet rest on the floor. Be aware of your whole lower body from your sit bones down through your legs to your feet. So you feel like you have an anchor to your sitting position. And then bring your awareness to your breathing. You can feel the breath come in and fill you up like a balloon. I can feel the breath go out and empty you. So go ahead and be aware of that, of that process happening, that you're inhaling and filling, and you're exhaling and emptying. And watch that process happen. Watch the end of the exhale move right into the beginning of the next inhale. And the inhale move right into the exhale. So you're cultivating a breath that's even with no pauses. And as you rest here, you might find that it deepens and slows. If you're new to breathing, you can bring a hand to your chest and a hand to your navel and feel the breath moving in your body. You can feel how your body fills through your hands. You can feel your body fill as you inhale and how your body empties as you exhale. So you're training your mind to pay attention to your breath. So instead of your usual mental activity of being engaged outward, your mind is now filled with the sensations of breathing, of breath coming in and out of your body, and the feeling of your physical form resting and breathing. Good. And you can open your eyes. This is a very basic practice, and yet so many of us don't take that minute that we just took and shift our nervous system to a more relaxed state. It's simple, it's fast, you can do it in the course of your day, at the traffic light, in the grocery line. That in itself is a powerful practice for shifting your nervous system to a more calm, relaxed, receptive, intuitive, safe place. So I encourage you to practice that. All right. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is actually what meditation does to the neural structures in our brain. So before we can talk about those neural structures, I need to talk to you about what are those structures? I'm going to describe to you your neural anatomy, the brain anatomy, so that when we talk about the studies done, it makes sense to you. All right. So you all know that your spinal cord runs through your spinal column, right? It's a thick cord of nerve axons and nerve cells that run up and down through your spine. And once it comes into your skull, it becomes the brain stem. That brain stem is called your medulla and your pons, and they take care of all that sort of basic function like heart rate, breathing rate. When people are in a coma, their brain stem, their lower brain functions are active, but their higher might not be. They might be brain dead, but still they're breathing and their heart rate's beating. So that's this lower part of our part of the brain, that brain stem. And then above that, in the center of our head, is called the midbrain, or sometimes it's called the reptilian brain. That is where our limbic system lives. It's below our cerebral cortex, which is all about higher function, but this lower brain is where the limbic system lives, and I'm going to describe to you the main parts of that limbic system. So these are the parts of the limbic system. So the thalamus is really it's in the center of our brain. There's a kind of an almond shape, think about it as being like the size of an avocado pit, right? These two kind of nodular things in the center of your brain, and they're really a relay station for integrating sensory information. So just like the basic, maybe you're folding laundry while you're watching this on your computer screen. The act of you folding laundry and engaging visually would be governed by this thalamus, the ability to find yourself in space and do simple things like move across the stage without falling off. That would involve my thalamus. All right, relay station. Hypothalamus is right below it, and it's really involved in endocrine function, because the pituitary gland is right underneath that. The hypothalamus regulates pretty much all of our endocrine glands. And most particularly, we care about it in this context because it triggers, it makes a hormone which stimulates the adrenal gland to make cortisol, which is a chronic stress hormone. The other parts of this reptilian brain are called the amygdala and the hippocampus. The amygdala is the main center for triggering this fight or flight response, as in panicking, as in I'm not safe here. So there's a lot of sensory interaction, especially from visual stimuli, that goes right to the amygdala, and it tells the body that it's not safe and it needs to respond to that lack of safety. Okay, so when people feel afraid, when people have PTSD, when they've been through traumatic experiences, and we look at their brains, their amygdalae are bigger. There's more mass to them. When people don't feel afraid or meditate, their amygdalae tend to shrink. More about that in a minute. The hippocampus is right next to the amygdalae in this core place in our brain, and it's actually involved in several things. It's involved in memory. In fact, it's involved in the consolidation of short-term memory into long-term memory. Important. It's also involved in spatial memory, like remembering, if you think about this being reptilian brain, remembering where the food is or where the thing that's going to eat me is. You know, where is our danger? Where is our safety? Where is their food? That kind of spatial memory is here. And then it's also, you know, the more we study neural structures, the more we see that you can't just say that this structure does one thing. Most structures do multiple things. And hippocampus is also involved in emotional regulation. All right. So that's our limbic system. And then above the limbic system is like this, it's called the cortex, the cerebral cortex. It's our higher functioning brain. You can imagine it as like the cap of a mushroom on top of the stem, right? The stem comes up, and there's this global umbrella over that stem. And you've probably studied this in fifth grade. You have four different lobes. You have two hemispheres, one on each side, with a central divider. The two sides are connected by what's called the corpus callosum, which are just connecting fibers from right and left side. But there's lobes in each side that we roughly associate with different kinds of processing. So the occipital lobe back here is all about the assimilation of visual stimuli, right? Then the here on the sides of your head, up higher, are called the parietal lobes, and they're also sensory integrators, mostly touch. And then your temporal lobes are by your ears, so they're more about auditory stimulation. Speech, language is all centered there. And then you get to our frontal lobes. Our frontal lobes are what make us human. Our frontal lobes are where we give credit in our brain for having all the higher functioning, the things that make us human, like creativity, like problem solving, like the modification of our behavior to be socially acceptable. So following rules, assessing risk, and also higher functions like altruism and empathy are also said to be in this front part of our brain, in our frontal lobes. Okay. So there, you've had a very brief neuroanatomy lesson about the structures in your brain. Okay. So when science looks at those parts of our brain, and really, this is still in its infancy. It's looked, again, there's thousands of studies. There have been studies on long-term meditators, like Buddhist monks. There's been studies on college students who never meditated, and now they're in an 8-week course. So you have a huge range of subjects in these research studies. And so rather than pulling out this one or that one, I'm going to merge all the data for you that I've been reading in the last few weeks and what makes most sense to me about that data. And I'm sure there'll be more coming. So far, what seems to happen when people meditate regularly, and it could be 20 to 30 minutes, 20 to 40 minutes, most days of the week is what the studies kind of look at. The Buddhist meditators are doing hours a day, but most of the studies are not Buddhist meditators. They're people who have a modest practice. And what we see in brain anatomy is that the amygdala shrinks. Right? The amygdala shrinks. That's an arrow going down. Right? So that means the triggers for us to feel afraid, the triggers for us to shift into fight or flight is less. So there's actually less mass. So thanks to modern technology, thanks to PET scans and functional MRIs, we can look at brain activity, we can see the density of tissue, the mass of certain areas in the brain, and judge what's happening over time in a meditator's brain. So we see this survival mechanism, this lower brain function, diminish, right? We see the hippocampus actually increasing, right? In some studies, the hippocampus increased, and it was correlated with a greater sense of self-regulation, a greater emotional balance. Remember, we said hippocampus is involved in memory and emotional regulation. The other thing that we know is that when people are stressed out, chronically stressed out, when we're in fight or flight most of the time, our hypothalamus is working overtime and our adrenals are working overtime to make cortisol. And what we see in meditators is that this whole, it's called the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis, calms down. So there's less cortisol. I'm going to pause there for a second. There's a concept here that I just want to make a point of. So when we think about the parasympathetic nervous system, and how we triggered it by breathing. That activity is called vagal tone. When you have more activity in your parasympathetic nervous system, you have more activity in your vagus nerve. So we say you have more vagal tone. That is equivalent to an increase in heart rate variability. Heart rate variability should be here. Increase in a heart rate variability. Sorry for all the terms. But heart rate variability is a hot topic, and you as meditators probably already have it down. So what does it mean? It means that, I'm going to sit for a second. I want you to take your pulse. So find a pulse point, maybe in your wrist or right here in your neck. Go ahead and feel the rate of your heart. And now feel yourself breathing while you're feeling your pulse rate. Feel your breath come in, feel your breath go out. So be conscious of breathing deep and slow. And just notice, is there any variation in your pulse when you link it to your breath? Now, when people are stressed, there's not any variation. There's low heart rate variability, right? When people are relaxed or they have more activity in their parasympathetic nervous system, they have more variability. So variability is a good thing, okay? So if I'm sitting here feeling my pulse and I'm on and I'm talking to you, I don't have a lot of parasympathetic tone right now, even though I'm enjoying myself. I'm still on. I'm kind of in fight or flight. I have more activity in sympathetic mode than parasympathetic. So I don't have a lot of variability right now, which means my heart's beating steadily no matter what I'm doing. I'm breathing and my heart's beating, right? But for you, if you're relaxed at home, or if I was relaxed at home or meditating, what you see is your heart beats. As you inhale, it goes beat, and it speeds up a little bit. So instead of going beat, 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 it goes beat, 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 beat as you inhale. And as you exhale, it goes beat, 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 beat. So it slows down as you exhale. It speeds up as you inhale. It slows down as you exhale. That is a sign of health. That is a sign that your brain is connected to your heart via the vagus nerve. It's a sign that you have resilience, that you have an ability to respond to stress, to respond to your life. So it's sort of a nervous system agility test. All right. So the point is that meditation calms our sympathetic, increases our parasympathetic, and then increases our vagal tone, which makes our heart rate variability higher, more variable, more fluid, more reactive, responsive. And that's a good thing. In fact, low heart rate variability is linked to all kinds of chronic diseases. It's linked to depression. It's linked to death after a heart attack. It's linked to diabetic neuropathy. It's linked to SIDS, all kinds of things that are not good. So we know that heart rate variability is a sign of health and a sign of future health. All right. So how else is our brain affected? We talked about our limbic system and our fight or flight responses. Now let's look at our cortex, at the cerebral cortex. What happens in our higher functioning parts of our brain when we meditate regularly? All right. This is where it's a little bit complicated, and I'm going to make it simple. So just excuse me if you want more neuroanatomy. I'm going to give you a little bit. So in our frontal cortex, we have what's called a prefrontal cortex. It's the front of the front of the brain. And we have a medial and a lateral part. So the medial is like inside of that sulcus, that fissure in the middle. And the lateral is on the sides. And basically, those parts of our frontal cortex are assessing relationship. Our medial frontal cortex has to do with self-reference, has to do with how am I in the midst of things. In fact, I always think of Rolf Sovic's comment that he teaches during our teacher training. He says, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, which is pretty much the human condition. So that self-referencing part of our brain is always assessing how this is affecting me. You know, so I take things personally because that is affecting me, or you did that on purpose to affect me. There's a way that self-referencing part of my mind keeps me in a more suspicious, evaluating, maybe less relaxed state of mind. Right? Whereas my lateral prefrontal cortex is much more about other assessing or a bigger picture. And so the activity there is more likely to make me feel like I'm joined to people, I'm connected to people, I'm part of the human race, I'm part of this, or my community, or my church. Or there's a way that my perspective is more balanced. How is this event affecting everyone, not just me? So when we look at meditators' brains, what we see is that over time, there is less activity in that self-referencing place and more activity in the other referencing place. So there's less activity in the medial prefrontal cortex, and there's more in the lateral prefrontal cortex, which I think is just astounding. It feels like, if you consider all these things, that we're actually moving toward a higher state of consciousness, that we're separating from our reptilian brain, you know, fear and survival and everyone, you know, the survival of the fittest, and more toward a more community-minded, respect and love for all, more state of mind, which I think is just beautiful. The last thing that I want to talk about here on the board here is this default mode network. Default mode network, I heard about it first about 4 years ago, but I think I'd known about it for maybe 10. And it's basically this idea that when we're not thinking about anything, we default into this sort of rambling, non-focused state of mind. Right? I'm waiting for the bus to come and my mind is rambling around on whatever happened this morning and what's going to happen later and whatever, right? So it's an unfocused part of our mind and or a way that our mind is working. When we spend a lot of time in that mode, in that unfocused, rambling mind, we tend to worry or ruminate or perseverate on things that didn't go right. And actually, so far, the studies look like when people spend a lot of time in that mode, they're more likely to have anxiety and depression and mental health problems. So what's interesting is that when we use the part of our brain in our frontal cortex that's about training attention and focusing, it turns that off because they're the opposite. You either be not focused or be focused. So when you practice focusing, you turn off that default mode network. So we have less activity there, and therefore a better chance at positive mental health, at positive thinking patterns, contentment, happiness, self-esteem. All right, so that's pretty good. If you're not meditating yet, you might want to think about it because I just said a lot of good things about the changes in your brain. All right. I want to do another practice. So come find your seat again. So plant your feet on the floor. Find a comfortable place to sit for your hips to rest. You can rest your hands on your thighs. You can close your eyes. So again, feel your body resting. Let it sink into its supports. Feel the top of your head lifting, and let there be a long line between your sit bones or your sacrum and tailbone all the way up to the top of your head. Let the shoulders come down and back. A little lift in the breastbone. And then again, for a moment, go to your breath. Feel your breathing deep and slow. And this time, bring your attention to your breath in your nostrils. Feel as you inhale, how the breath coming in through the nostrils is cool. And feel as you exhale how the breath is warm. And use that sensation, that subtle difference between the inhaled breath and the exhaled breath as your focus. If the mind wanders, bring it back. And then, as you inhale, imagine that you're inhaling up through the nose, up through the bridge of the nose, past the corners of the eyes, and up into the forehead. And exhaling down from the forehead, through the bridge of the nose, out through the nostrils. We all know this isn't where the breath is actually moving. The breath actually comes in, down to the lungs, and back out. But somehow the act of breathing up into the mind is so much more rich. So much more satisfying. So play with that again for the next couple of minutes. Inhaling, feel the breath in the nostrils, along the roof of the nostrils, up through the bridge of the nose, the corners of the eyes, and all the way up into the center of the mind. And exhale down and out through the nostrils. You're training your attention. You're turning off your default mode network. You're allowing the mind to rest. If you have a mantra, you could go to your mantra. Otherwise, just stay with the breath. And gently open your eyes. I've looked at, or I've seen TED Talks of some of the researchers at Harvard, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Drs. Lazar, Drs. Davidson, so many of these researchers that have been looking at this over the last decade or more. And pretty much all of them who are excited about meditation are meditators. They're meditators with scientific minds, and they're curious about what's happening inside of their own laboratories. You know, I saw one particularly striking segment of a TED Talk. And Dr. Lazar at Harvard is saying how when she started out, she didn't believe any of it was true. Like, what do you mean? You sit around and you breathe deeply, and you know, she thought yoga was silly, and how could it possibly change my brain? How could it possibly change my sense of well-being? How could it possibly change my ability to be more loving in the world? And now that it's been 20 years since she started meditating, she's like, and it did. Like, that's the reality. That's from a critical, skeptical, scientific mind to today. She's gone, went from being, it can't possibly be true, to, my word, look at that. It's true. That our conscious control of this amazing vehicle in our head can create so much good in our own minds, but for each other as well. So I want to recap. So if you look at all the things that happen in your brain when you meditate, you're shifting your usual way of being away from the animal, the survival, the amygdala, the fight or flight response, the everything is scary and threatening, to a much more open, trusting, community-minded, other-focused, or we-focused instead of I-focused state of being. That in the end creates more health in our minds, right? We know that these practices help people who have depression and anxiety and PTSD and anger issues and addiction issues. We know that there is this shift toward improvement in our mental health because of that shift from our animal nature to our higher, our human capacity. And then there's this this potential, really, to bring about a much more of a universal connectedness. People say they have more empathy. They have more ability to see things from somebody else's point of view. So it's a more of a holistic perspective toward the world, and what's best for me is best for everybody, as opposed to just what I want. So we see people moving into a healthier place mentally. All those studies that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk about how we see people improving from blood pressure and endocrine problems and cancer survivorship, all those things. I feel like that's why we're seeing that shift, is because when people do this, their bodies are also healthier. Oh, I didn't say. It's not on my board. The other thing that happens globally when we meditate is that we shift away from this high cortisol into less inflammation. We shift into a place where we actually support our inherent healing capacity. And the piece that I also forgot to say is about aging, that when we meditate as we age, we see less deterioration of the cortex. Science expects older people to lose their cortical width, their density of their cortex. And what we see, when you look at meditators over time, they don't lose that. They don't lose their cortical thickness. They maintain it or even rebuild it. And if you start meditating as an older person, you actually see the neurogenesis, the creation of those new neurons, the plumping up of the hippocampus, the plumping up of that prefrontal cortex in areas that promote compassion. Another thing that I want to say was that about aging is that when we meditate, we lessen our inflammation, and we increase our cortical thickness, and we increase our telomere length. And telomere length has been associated with longevity. That over time our telomeres shrink, and that when we meditate, they maintain or lengthen. If you didn't get that memo, telomeres are the ends of your chromosomes. They're like they've been likened to the plastic tips on shoelaces, where it preserves the integrity of that chromosome. And what happens over time, or as we age, or as we deteriorate, really, is those telomeres get shorter, and then finally that cell can't reproduce anymore. That cell dies. So telomere length predicts, longevity predicts health. So there's all these, not just for aging, but in general, all these links to health and wellness come about because of meditation, because of shifting our usual way of being out of fight or flight and into a more relaxed, present, safe, open place. And really, this is about neuroplasticity. You know, we said at the beginning that neuroplasticity means that my brain is adapting, it's growing and changing and evolving based on my experiences. So what's happening? I'm making new neural connections between, let's say, my sensory input and the part of my cortex that's about others, right? I'm building more connections in my sense of compassion and perspective about the big picture. And I'm pruning or cutting back on those connections that go from my sensory input to my amygdala to my sympathetic nervous system. So I have less wiring in that sympathetic reactive fight or flight response. And I'm building new wiring around my ability to be in the world, to respond from a calm, centered place, from a perspective of us instead of me. Like, all those things are happening because of that simple 30-minute practice every day in the morning. It's pretty phenomenal. All right. The bottom line really for me is that meditative practice helps every part of you, every part of me, mind, body, health, longevity, and also the sense of connectivity, of love and compassion, and of purpose in the world. All those things feel related to me. There's a way that life feels meaningful, vital, exciting, enthusiastic. You know, enthusiasm comes from that prefrontal cortex too. You have more liveliness about your life when you engage in this way in your whole being. So I hope that's given you some motivation to continue to forge ahead in your personal practice, and if you're new, to establish it, and if you're curious, to maybe try it. All right. If you need more information, there's lots more information on the Himalayan Institute website and Amrit blog and Wisdom Library, so please check them out. And thank you for being with me today.